Hey guys, this is Sharad with Recently, host of the Recently podcast. I have a double pleasure of doing this podcast for the second time with Danny Petor. We tried a new platform last time and for some reason the recording was all messed up. So Danny was super gracious to come on the podcast again and share the wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much, Danny. Welcome to the Recently podcast.
You know, pleasure again. And I know how those things happen and it's quite all right. And you know what? In real estate, we always have to be ready for those things, you know,
right?
Even if it's just technology. So that's a common practice in our world, right?
Yeah, we were trying out a new platform and then we decided to just go back to Zoom and keep it simple for everyone.
Makes sense.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. Hey, Danny, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you joining in from? What do you do? And how long have you been doing that for?
Pleasure. Thanks. And thanks for having me. Always, I love the opportunity to share. So I'm Danny Petor. I live in Southern California in the Orange County area. I'm originally from Israel. I moved to the States 20 years ago, exactly 20 years ago. I moved to Northern California. I lived in Northern California for 10 years. Then moved down to Southern California. Unlike a lot of people who hear that and know the path of moving to Northern California and maybe to another part of the country, I was not relocated by a corporation, by corporate America. For me, I actually started investing in US real estate a little bit over 20 years ago, 22, 23 years ago, when I was a young engineer, high-tech engineer, working for a high-tech company in Tel Aviv, in Israel. Asking myself what to do with the funds that I was able to, kind of the little bit of funds that I was able to save at the time, maybe dabbling a little bit in stocks and options and not really happy about the results and or the risk reward kind of a formula. And I was on a quest. I was in a life quest. It's kind of funny. Yesterday I wrote to someone who asked me about my journey. And I started that quest 22, 23, actually probably almost 25 years ago, financial quest or financial journey. And I told at the end, I said, I didn't even step down of that financial path. I'm still on that path because I always think that there's always more to learn, to teach myself, to investigate. It never really ends. But that back then, I didn't know where it's going to lead me. It did lead me into considering investing in US real estate. I bought my first rental property in 2002, so about 22, 23-ish years ago from Tel Aviv. I bought a house outside of Phoenix, Arizona, and completely sight unseen, completely, you know, remotely, no Zillow, no public records online. You know, the MLS document came through the fax. Looks like if everybody knows what a poor fax looks like, that's exactly how it looked like. Could barely read, the document. So completely different investing environment. But for me, it just was very clear message. This is the right path to invest my money. And I kind of fell in love with that concept of US, investing in the US. And in 2004, we decided, my wife and I, to just pack our bags and come over. And to me, there was only one thing to do, do real estate more, get more involved with real estate. I wanted to kind of throw myself into it and not just be on the sideline, doing it from the sideline. From 2004 till now, it's all been remote real estate, investing in other states, investing out of state or in other states on a very large scale and helping my clients to do the same. So I've done about help clients buy something around 5,000, give or take, long-term rental properties in that past 20 years in more than 45 different US metros. So everything we do in a large scale, a relatively large scale, working with individuals, helping them facilitate. In many ways, I'm a very much of a real estate geek, but I would say it's a single family home, long-term rental kind of a geek. So that's my passion is over there. I don't do every type of real estate. I just focus on those things. I've done different things over the years. I've done notes and I've done liens and tax deeds and land and a little bit commercial and flipping. I've done actually quite a bit of flipping, but the majority of the comfort zone, what I know well, is long-term residential rentals out of state, kind of our concept. And that's
amazing,
what we do.
Man. I love the focus, man. I love the focus on one niche and then just like really being the expert. Before we get into like, you know, what kind of clients you're working with, how you're helping them, I'm curious, like, what was it about real estate? I mean, you were like fully 100% committed to real estate, you know, buying. I mean, it's not buying out of state. It's like buying out of country from Israel, completely sight unseen. You know, I mean, if you can imagine like 20 years ago, no Zillow, no, you know, WhatsApp technologies where you can easily exchange pictures. It was a different experience. But what was it about real estate that you were like, man, I have to get my, you know, I have to jump in and I have to get this thing done?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'll even say when I started, Google was a startup.
Yeah.
We use MapQuest. Google Maps were not around. So it's that's how far back we're going.
Yeah, no screen, Google Street View, none of that. Yeah, none of that
existed. Yeah. So in a way, it's gotten to be easier from many aspects.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And you know, every once in a while, I kind of ask myself, am I in the right spot? Like maybe a year, once a year, I kind of get that thought like, okay, hey, hang on, let's take a breather. Let's review. You know, maybe I'm kind of questioning myself. Am I doing the right thing? Is real estate the right thing? Is residential real estate the right thing? And you know what? It all comes back to the same kind of a starting point where I, you know, the defined aspect of it is when it comes to long-term residential real estate investing, I think it's the only financial mechanism. When I say financial vehicle or mechanism, I mean everything, stocks, options, you know, it's the only one that I know it has a reverse correlation between risk and reward. So it's not risk-free, but I am not familiar with many or any financial vehicles, investment opportunities at large that usually, typically, we know the risk and reward go hand in hand, right? You do stocks, you understand the risk and reward relationship. You do options, you same thing. You're flipping, you're doing, you know, there's risk and reward, you know, go hand in hand. In long-term residential rentals, for the most part, it's actually not that there's a reverse correlation, but I think there's a big disconnect between, in a good way, between the risk and reward. You are taking risk, but relatively the rewards are quite tremendously high or could be relatively to the risk. And that for me, you know, if you're kind of thinking about it, that alone is a very powerful concept to start, you know, considering investing in something. It's true for different types of real estate, but I think just the U.S. residential market presents a very different opportunity because that is not something I can say on the Israel residential market, right? It's not behaving the same way, right? It's very different in many, many ways. And I haven't checked many places on the world, but that for me was the basic unique aspect. From there, you know, it's just gotten to be better and better in many ways. Again, relatively to the risk reward that, you know, that I was looking for. So first of all, I could tell that the stocks and options that I've done for about a year and a half, maybe two before, I was not happy about the risk reward. The reward were there, but I knew the risk is also much higher. So that already told me, hey, something is off with this formula. I need a better formula. The second thing is real estate inherently is not typically something you buy on a Monday and sell on the Tuesday the following day, right? So it kind of locks you in. When you're locked in, even if you get nervous about something, you can't react quickly, unlike stocks or something like that, like a day trader or anything like that. So it inherently forces you to shut down the emotional aspect of it, and you have to be more reasoning with everything. Now, there are a lot of challenges. You know, there could be many challenges. I've encountered many, many different challenges in many directions, you know, throughout the years, including the crash of 2008, which was a very big, it was an epic, challenging time personally and through the clients that I work with. But that actually forces you not to take an immediate, you can't take an immediate emotional reaction and sell it. you actually have to dive back in and say, okay, how do I get of that? How do I solve that situation? Or how do I navigate that situation? And I found that I'm good when I'm good with trying minimizing the chances of running into problems, you know, but problems or situations or, you know, or challenges will present themselves along the way for sure. And I'm good with navigating, you know, the situation. Actually, the more I dive in, 20 years later, I still feel like I'm digging into different situations. I'm still very good with navigating them. So I think it was a good match between my personality, the risk reward, the lack of ability to respond emotionally. And that was the love, the love affair between those two, the right person and the right financial vehicle. And I saw how this could be benefiting me. At the time, I didn't see how I can help and how through this I can help and benefit others. I was just looking for my own kind of narrow interest, and I just felt this is the right one for me. So that was the starting point.
Yeah, Danny, I 100% agree with that, man. I've noticed that with my own real estate investing portfolio. I bought my first property like 14 years ago in 2010. And when I look at it in hindsight, I think the risk was very, very minimal. You know, I ran my numbers, I did my due diligence. The risk was very, very minimal, but the reward has been absolutely amazing. It's been, and it keeps getting better every year. Market value is going up, the rental is going up. So once you've locked in the price, then after that, like everything else is going up from there. The revenue potential, your revenue is going up, the market value is going up. So it's been absolutely incredible. And one thing you mentioned, which I 100% agree with, is you also have to factor in your personality. You know, you might look at other people that are absolutely crushing it with wholesaling, flipping, or doing some creative things. You have to ask yourself, hey, is that something you're comfortable doing? I was not. I noticed when I started investing, a lot of people talking about wholesaling, flipping, just my personality did not feel comfortable. And you and I have that in common. When I started investing, before I started investing in real estate, I looked at stocks, bonds, and it wasn't a good fit for my personality, because I would just get like too excited about stock going up, going down. I couldn't take it. And we tell the investor the same thing when it comes to marketing. You have to do what fits your personality. Don't look at what other people are doing. What fits your personality?
Exactly. That's
you made a really, really good point. So I wanted to make sure that I highlight that.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Like, so you started buying properties for yourself. I love that. Like buying out of country, sight unseen, before all these, you know, the technology advances that we have. Like, you really, really wanted that freedom of time and money to go after that. So that's, I absolutely respect that, man. Then how did it go from what you were buying properties for yourself? Now you have helped, you know, you've been involved in over 5,000 deals. How did that go from there to helping other investors? Like, tell us a little bit about that. Like, what does that journey look like?
So I really look at those 20 years-ish since 2004, 20 years, as two periods. There is the period leading to the 2008 crash and the period after, okay? Maybe I should say three periods, the one leading, during, and after. Before, it was more about, you know, helping people, kind of generally pointing them in the right direction. They ask questions, and very... the support level and the level of involvement was very, I would say, minimal, superficial. It wasn't, you know, not superficial. It wasn't diving into the details as much. When the crash hit, personally, I have already accomplished my 5-year plan. I was able to accomplish it in about 2.5 years. So I had more properties than I planned, sooner than I planned at that time. I was still a young guy, still, you know, kind of working and buying, but I was very much moving forward with buying as much as I can. And that actually came at a point where I was heavily leveraged, heavily dependent my income on real estate, and everything got hit, meaning both my income and the cash flow, the negative cash flow that I was using at the time, buying with negative cash flow, was a double whammy. So right there, it threw me into that situation that I had to dive into all the details in order to dig myself out of that situation. But that there's two things that I, you know, happened around that time that me, myself, and I made a promise to myself and I, right? Two things that I decided to do right there. First of all, I had a lot of clients in a similar situation, right? Pretty much similar situation. So the promise number one was any one of my clients who's calling to vent, complain, cry, anything, whatever, right? I'm going to be there, pick up the phone and answer it. So I have taken every single call, and that those type of calls lasted from 2008 all the way to 2009, maybe even 10. So they started dying off. So for about 2.5 years, maybe close to 3, I was taking negative phone calls for my clients, negative conversations or, you know, not easy conversation to have. And I told myself, first of all, leadership is someone who doesn't disappear when times are tough. Second, maybe they just need to vent to someone. I'll be that person for them if they need to. Because when things don't go according to the plan, you're always looking for someone to blame. You're never the one who's responsible. You're always looking for someone to blame. And you know what? I said, I'll be there. I'll help them. Then maybe because I'm anyway diving into the details and myself being in that situation, maybe I know something that I can still try and give them support, direction, guidance to help their personal situation. And maybe even they're going through or found something that they worked for them that I can benefit both personally and maybe even share it with the next guy who calls, right? So let me just tell you, this was not fun, right? No fun to have those conversations, but I kept my word to myself and I was there. When things started, those kind of conversations started kind of dying out or kind of slowing down or even eventually stopping at the outside of the crash. When around 2010, when I saw that we are turning the corner, right? You don't see it immediately. Just in, you know, when you pass the corner, you actually understand you're past the corner. You think at least. You don't even know for sure. Not at that point. The second thing I told myself, like, you've gone through a very difficult time personally, financially, real estate wise. Personally, I took the time to dig and become much more knowledgeable about real estate. And I'm going to take all that information. So at least if I went through that, it's my obligation to my clients, to the people I work or who decide to work with us, to share that with them so they can benefit from that, right? So that was the second promise. Is at least there, I will leverage that unpleasant times and lots of experience, and I will share it with my, you know, with my clients so they can benefit and learn and avoid those mistakes. And basically, I went after the crash and I said, okay, I'm building everything from scratch. How do we approach finding markets? How do we approach finding teams? Teams usually means realtors and property managers. How do we train them? What do we want from them? How do we approach to making this, analyzing financially and evaluating quality properties? I'm very much checklist systems and process kind of a person. And those, all that infrastructure was deeply established after the crash. So it's no longer just very minimal support. It's detailed. It's down to the details. There's very clear procedures and steps and systems and support in order for me to walk the path and my clients to walk the path. And I'll tell you that although I've created those paths with all that checklist and systems and support, etc., more than 10 years ago, it's continuously being refined and improved. I'm actually just making quite a few changes on how we work with property managers and few more tiny changes about how we look at houses, just something that happens in the past 2 weeks, right? Those are, one is a major change and two are minimal changes, but all of them are very, very important for the success, for the safety, for the improvement of our system. So that has been the second promise, is to make sure you know, people benefit from that, my experience. And I always ask myself, am I a survivor of the crash or am I a beneficiary of the crash? Am I a graduate or a survivor? I tend to be a graduate or a beneficiary and not a survivor, because that's how I feel the crash, you know, benefited me more. It's more long term. It more benefited me than what happened then. And I will tell you, the financial and emotional scars are still not visible, but felt. So I haven't forgot about them either.
No, man, I think you make great point. Everybody goes through tough times. I started my investing journey. I was definitely the beneficiary of the downturn because I started in 2010. The property values were like, I mean, you could just buy any house from MLS that you wanted. Nobody was looking at houses. It was just, it was insane when you compare it to the market right now.
Insane.
But yeah, but it's amazing that, you know, when you go through tough times, it's not the tough times that you go through, how you come out of those, you know, what lessons you learn, how you apply those lessons to your life. That is what tells your character. You know, there's one is like, you could just, you know, you had all these clients calling. One response would be, all right, I'm not going to take this call. You know, it's out of my control. What am I going to do about it? The other is, hey, I'm going to show up for my client. I understand they're going through this. I'm going to be support for them. Whatever they want to, you know, do, they want to cry, they want to vent, they want to be frustrated, I'm going to be there for them. And I'm going to learn something from it and come out with a better process. So, man, amazing, amazing work on that. Yeah. How do you, like, when you came out of it, you know, looking back after the crash and looking at like 2024 now, how do you identify markets? Like, what, if I were to ask you, hey, what are your top two or three markets to invest in, Danny? What would you say? And how do you identify them?
Well, I have a very clear criteria, and I'll share with you how I look at markets, and they have to meet that criteria almost to the teeth. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the exception to the rule, because there are markets that fit well on paper, but don't fit well in real life. I'll give you a few examples. So first of all, I like to look at areas around the country that are, the metro is at least one ideally 1.5. I would probably go to 1 million and above, ideally 1.5 or bigger. So size of the metro is important. The migration pattern are also important. I want to be in metros that are repeatedly and projecting to see more US migration patterns that are growing, to be on the receiving end of those migration patterns. I want to see metros that are diverse in different types of employers and do have multiple large employers. So for example, Vegas for me has everything I just mentioned, but doesn't have the diversification as much. So I'm not excited about Vegas. And by the way, anybody who's looking at Vegas, in the past two crises that happened in this country, Vegas was the one of the leading suffering metro. I'm talking about COVID and I'm talking about the crash of 2008. This is not the case on any of other markets. None or just one of the two. So just as an example, I like landlord friendly laws. So Republican states, ideal. Also, you know, I call it an important secondary, and that's weather pattern, or I more look at it as I try to stay away from harsh winters. And that, as you know, this is, for example, I don't really have a problem selling or leasing a house in the middle of winter in December or January in Florida. That is not the case in Chicago, Indianapolis, et cetera, right? And I don't normally have a house HVAC heating crashes when it's vacant in the winter in Florida. Or if it does, it's no big deal, right? That's not the case in the winter of the harsh winter. So that's why I try to avoid. It's not that we don't go to areas with winter, just harsh winter is not my preference. Once I find a metro that qualifies, it's all about the numbers. So we like to go into the upper middle class, middle middle class, lower middle class kind of communities, cities, and neighborhoods. And then I want to see how much we can buy it for and what is the rent, and check the cash flow. So a lot of people like to use the 1% rule. I don't know if people think it still applies. I don't think it applies anymore, but I don't use that rule ever. I always dive down to our analysis Excel. I want to see the bottom line. I do not use rent for, rent is not something I can go to the supermarket and buy groceries. Cash flow is really important. So for that example, we can buy, a house in a similar area. So the profile is very similar of the community for a similar price, and it will still generate a whole, very different cash flow just because of property taxes and insurance as an example. So it's really important not to be a rule of thumb, which I don't like, rule of thumb, the 1% rule, but actually dive into the details. So for me, it's analyzing multiple properties, segmenting different parts of the metro in order to see how do the numbers work, if at all. And if they work, okay, we are ready to move to the next level, which is setting up teams. But if it doesn't, we may move to another market. So that's just to give you an example how we go about the general guidelines. That being said, there are exceptions. Now, some of those exceptions are only coming from someone with experience or actual experience. So let me give you a few examples. Example number one, Dallas and Houston, great markets in many ways. They follow the protocol of everything I've mentioned so far, but they have two problems. Problem number one, insurance rates in past few years keep rising year after year after year on an annual basis. So it's eating into the cash flow, and we are chasing the cash flow on an annual basis, even with 3% interest rates, still a challenge and for many years. Second, and this is something I see mostly in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, less in Houston, but it will probably start trickling. Counties in that area assess and update property values on an annual basis. So on an annual basis, you get a hit with the property taxes. Whether you can protest it or not, or you do, or not, it doesn't matter at the moment. I'm just saying it's a constant challenge to chase the cash flow. So here's two markets that are perfect. We have many properties in those two markets. I love those markets. Right now with the interest rate, it's just impossible to find the cash to cash flow even a little bit. And then you have the problem of year after year after year, those costs are going up. By the way, it's not the case around the country. Counties do not necessarily go year after year and update the value, and then the property taxes are increasing dramatically year after year. So that's an example of two areas that don't really work financially. There's another area that I've been to, which is Atlanta, Georgia, which is, again, perfect on paper, perfect. After a few years of operating there, me and some of my bigger investors, we're just enough. We found that the same segment of the market, the upper middle class, middle class, lower middle class, we have more issues with tenants than we have in anywhere else, and more issues with vendors than anywhere else. It was kind of an unofficial discussion, but there was conversation that was going on, and we all came to that conclusion at the same time. And for that reason, although it's a great market in many ways, we decided to phase out of that. So the reality was, we are having a lot of issues with the tenants and vendors in this market, and the similar properties in other markets for the similar population, segment of the population, not even close. So that is another example of something that qualifies but doesn't qualify. And I'll give you one more, and that'll be the last one. Oklahoma City, on paper, perfect. In reality, at 2015 or maybe 14, I decided no more Oklahoma City. We have quite a few properties there. Why no Oklahoma City? Well, all the markets around us appreciated quite nicely. Oklahoma City was slagging or kind of appreciated, but not even close to what all the other markets did. So financially, it was just not keeping up with the other ones. So that doesn't make it a bad market, but I see myself as in a position that I owe it to my clients to find the best option, right? If I know one market after 10 years is, and I had properties there, I sold them. After 10 years, it's consistently showing much slower appreciation than other markets. How can I recommend someone to go there when I know almost every other market that we pick are doing much better? Now, it's not obviously not a guarantee for the future, but I'm already know this one is not performing as strongly. So why would I? So those are general.
It's amazing. Man.
Only hands-on experience tells us, you know.
Yeah, the amount of
defined, yeah, details.
The amount of research and detail, that's amazing. So give me your top three markets across the U.S.
Okay. I think Kansas City is a very interesting market. I love that that one. St. Louis is also interesting. I think it's kind of flying below the radar. I hope you don't have a lot of listeners. I'm joking. I hope you do have a lot of listeners, but St. Louis, and when I say the name of the city, I actually mean the metro, is flying below the radar in terms of what's going on there. So for me, that's an interesting market, very much so. And then the third one is Nashville, but people tend to think about Nashville as a metro. For me, Nashville is not a metro. It is the metro of Nashville, but it's actually the greater area called the Middle Tennessee. That's a strip throughout, you know, almost crossing Tennessee from Georgia to Kentucky. It's called Middle Tennessee. Nashville is the big, you know, the big one in the middle, obviously, but it's not just the Nashville. It's much, much more than this Metro Nashville. It's called the Middle Tennessee. Those are the ones that I think are good. I will put an asterisk and say, I love Florida. If I can continue buying in Orlando and Tampa, I would continue buying in Tampa and Orlando. The problem is, one, the numbers are super tight. And two, more in Tampa, there's a lot of rentals. So there's a saturation of rentals. So right now, it's extremely hard to find something that would work in those two markets because either the numbers or the rental saturation. If those change, I would probably try to, even a little bit, I would probably go in. I think Florida is an excellent state to be.
Are there any insurance issues that you're concerned about in Florida with all the hurricanes and other weather-related issues?
Are you asking about insurance in the sense of expenses or the incident?
No, insurance in the term of expenses and some, you know, becoming harder to get insurance companies to underwrite insurance policies.
Okay.
It's not just Florida, you know, I mean, it's happening in other states also. Like, you know, I know State Farm and a couple of other big, I live in California. I know a couple of other big insurance companies pulled out of writing any new home insurance policy. So that's happening more and more, you know, in states that see weather related, you know, like wildfires, hurricanes. So I'm just curious if you factored that in.
So as much as I know, there are mainly two states that are suffering from this. I'm not sure about California. Remember, I live here, but I'm not operating here. So I can't say about California, but Texas and Florida are suffering from that aspect of insurance companies pulling out. I don't know which one is suffering more, but both of them are in that respect. In Florida, luckily, or there is this the state-run insurance company called Citizen.
Okay.
And I think by charter, Citizen has to insure you. So if you end up with none, this will be your default. And they are fair. They're not like exploiting that situation so far. So Citizen is the state-run organization. I've used them for a few years on at least one property. I'm actually shopping around right now and probably going to switch another to them. So that would be the option. I don't know if Texas has a similar problem. Remember that as investors, we are the big tail of the homeowners. And if the homeowners, which are the majority of the population in every state, usually the balance is 2/3 homeowners, 1/3 is investors at large, you know, on average, there will be an uproar in Texas or Florida if nobody's covering. Right. And the states usually, like in Florida, step in and do something about it. So I'm seeing maybe Texas, maybe they're already one, Texas insurance company, maybe. I don't know exactly. It's maybe not going to be cheap. In Florida, it always exists. I hope that doesn't go away. Definitely a concern, but with solutions. And, you know, we live in an economy of wealth of solutions. And many times when there's a gap, another company steps in and say, you know what, it's an opportunity for me to make more money and maybe structure the policy in one way. that the big corporations are saying, I don't want to touch it. It's too much problems for me.
Yeah,
and the small company says, you know what? For us, we're going to refine it to the teeth and we're going to exploit it, but at the same time, provide a solution that is acceptable. So that's my anticipation. Something like this would happen. Maybe you and I can do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, no, it's becoming, I know in California, I wasn't aware of Texas, but that's good to know. I know like California and Florida, I've heard, but man, this has been absolutely amazing, Danny. All right, man, we're going to move on to the next segment of the show, ask you some non-business related questions. All right, ready? You've done over 5,000 deals. What do you do for fun?
What do I do for fun? I bike. I ride mountain bike, which is I have a lot of places to go to. Driving from my house, so I don't even have to put it on the car. Probably 2 to 3 times a week. So that's one of my biggest passions. When I'm not mountain biking, I'll bike with my boy, which is great. And then spend time with my boy. That's my most valuable time ever. He's getting to be 12 or soon.
Nice.
And when I want to do something for my own soul, you know, usually the biking is does the work, does that. So that's my favorite thing.
That's amazing, man. All right, Danny, what's the most influential book that's been in your life? It could be a business book or a personal book, or you could name one of each.
I think the book that I like most is The Time Traveler's Wife, which when I read it, just blew my mind how an author can, in a book, move back and forth in time. You know, the concept was just amazing. The idea, they have done a movie about it on the book. The book became a movie, which usually movies do not do justice by the book. I think the movie actually relatively does justice well. So it's just a book that I always carry with me. I envy the author of even thinking about it, but also how that takes me through the journey. It's just mind blowing. Yeah. So that would be my top.
I'll definitely check it out. All right. Last question. If you could spend a day with anyone, dead or alive, who would you want to spend the day with and why?
That's a good question. Around what's happening now in the Middle East, I would want to sit down with Ben Gurion. Ben Gurion is the founder of Israel and is the George Washington of Israel in many sense. And I want to have a conversation and ask him, first of all, what do you think about what became? And also, what were you thinking about a few things that you started back then that we are still hitting today? So that'll be something. And I know where he's buried, in a very beautiful place in the southern part of Israel. I'm completely okay having that conversation on that nature balcony. It's like a balcony. It's not exactly a balcony in the residential sense. So I would sit with him there and have those conversations with him.
That's a great answer, man. That would be a very interesting conversation to have. Cool. All right, Danny, if someone wants to connect with you, learn more about you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Perfect. Yeah. So I have a web identity. It's Simply Do It. So that's the name of the company. All our social media is somehow Simply Do It. Anyone who can remember exactly how to connect with us, just write Real Estate Simply Do It or Danny Simply Do It, and you'll find anyone.
Yeah, we'll put
channels.
It in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be great. Our email is meet@simplydoit.net. Meet as in M-E-E-T @simplydoit.net. I'll be happy to connect with anyone who may think that we can help them invest. That's what we do day in, day out with great joy and pleasure.
Cool. Awesome, Danny. Thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the podcast again for the second time. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you, man.
Sure. Pleasure. Thank you.